What would you think about a man who had the capacity on some occasions to be proud and boastful? And he had a tremendous propensity to be rash with his words and to speak when he should be silent. And sometimes he's a little bit worldly minded. I'm sure you're always already ahead of me now. And on a few occasions, he's even prone to violence. And he's an occasional liar. And he's also a hypocrite. What would you think about a person like that? Well, you'd probably say, well, he's probably not on my top 10 list of spiritual models to follow after. Well, as you probably guessed, we're going to talk a little bit about the Apostle Peter tonight. And people are nodding. If I said that those were, that's really a fair characterization of Peter, you would probably say, that's a little bit misleading, isn't it? And that would be true. It's so easy for us to point out the failings and pick out the weaknesses of other people, and vice versa, very easy for them to pick out our personal weaknesses. And for most of us, somebody can make us look pretty bad. Pretty bad. If they just zeroed in on our weaknesses and talked about those things. And, you could do that with Peter if you wanted to. But I want us to think a little bit about the mistakes of Peter tonight. We know more about him than probably all the other apostles put together, with the exception of the Apostle Paul. We may know close to the same amount of material about Paul. But we know a lot about him, and he was probably the most outspoken member of the group, the leader, the informal leader. Certainly Jesus would have been the leader of the disciples, but Peter seems to be the outspoken person, and Jesus even seems to look at him in a sense that way. Peter sort of speaks for others. Jesus said that time, he said, are you guys going to leave me too? After all the 5,000 left him? And Peter says, where would we go? You're the one that has the eternal, one that has the words of eternal life. Peter stands up. He speaks for the others. It's Peter that Jesus singles out at the very end to talk about and say, feed my sheep. And we'll bring that up at the end of the lesson. Peter has a very prominent role, even at Pentecost. While I suspect other apostles preach too in that crowd of people, Peter's the one who gets the sermon that's prominent. He's featured. And even he and Paul can be paralleled in a way to outline the book of Acts. If you go through the book of Acts, you can go through the first half of Acts and look at the mirror of the second half, and you can see Peter and you can see Paul in the second half, and you can almost trace the parallels between them. He is a very important person and was given a lot of promise. And so, because he was so prominent, it's really all the more important that the New Testament presents Peter with both his failings and his successes. That's characteristic, isn't it, of the Bible? It's very honest. It's nothing new. Even Old Testament people that are very important to God's plan, whether it was Abraham or Moses or David, while they're great men, they're men of faith, all of those men, the Bible presents in a very honest way and shows us their positive attributes and their struggles. And so it's very significant because when you think about even our lesson that we were talking about this morning, that we are saved not by law, but by the mercy of God and His forgiveness. That even there, that kind of message is just for just such people as Peter. And it is for us too. That our faith can triumph over our failures. So let's look at a few examples. I just picked out a few examples from Peter's life of some of the mistakes he made. Let's just see if there's some lessons. Some of them that you will have thought of already, and a couple that I thought of that maybe you haven't noticed or given a lot of thought to, and you can supplement those with things that you've seen maybe in a Bible class. But look at Matthew 14. Here's my first example, Matthew chapter 14. In verse 24 and following, when Jesus sent the multitudes away, he went up on a mountain to pray, and it was evening, and he sent the apostles ahead of him in a boat, which is not uncharacteristic. There's numerous times that Jesus seemed to want to send them out in a boat, put them out in the middle of a storm. Sure enough, they get out in the middle of the sea, and the storm comes, and it's pelting the boat, and it's very intense. And Jesus, in the fourth watch of the night, verse 25, comes to them, and he's walking on the sea. And when the disciples see him, they cry out, they're afraid. And Peter says, Jesus says, take courage, it's me. He goes, I, don't be afraid. And Peter says, Lord, if it's you, command me to come down on the water. And we know the story. Peter gets out of the boat, and he walks, and he's walking to Jesus. I don't know how far he went. It kind of depends on which picture you're looking at in the Bible. One Bible shows he's gone about 4 feet and he's sinking, and then the other Bible shows it looks like he's gone maybe 20 feet. So I don't know how far he made it. But he's progressing along, and he takes his eyes off the Lord, and he begins to sink. And we, you know, this is a great lesson, you know. And we say, well, he started out successfully. But then, you know, good sermons and good studies for us, we always observe, you know, well, you know, he's on his way to being a true disciple, but then he takes his eye off of Jesus. And because of these different factors, these stormy things that enter his life, he begins to sink. And we say, well, that's, you know, there's Peter's mistake. And that's right, it was a mistake. He took his eyes off the Lord and worried about the things around him and didn't trust in Jesus. And there's a good lesson. Somebody put it this way, that even in a moment of great faith, we can be so quickly distracted by the world. And that meant something to me. That in the moment of the greatest faith, I mean, he is walking on water and showing real faith, but in the midst of the greatest moment of his faith, he was distracted and began to sink. That's a good lesson. But there's something else, too, that I thought of, another good lesson, and that is the practical lesson that for us is how many of us would have got off the boat? You know, how many of us would have got out of the boat to start with? How many of us would have thought to say if we had been on that boat that night in the middle of that storm, Lord, bid me come to you. Would you have done that? I mean, I don't know that I would have done that. How many of us sometimes don't see our failings of faith as clearly as Peter did because we don't risk very much? Let that sink in. You know what I'm saying? We don't risk very much, so we don't see the failings of our faith sometimes. We say, you know, I believe, I really believe in Jesus, but I exempt myself from the things that I feel are a little bit beyond me. That's for somebody else to do. I'm not going to do that. That's somebody else can do that probably better than me. And so I just somehow exempt myself from anything that's beyond my reach. So I'm kind of free and clear of a mistake, huh? But Peter didn't do that. He went out on a limb. And we see Jesus who said to Peter, he says of him later in this same incident, you know, he says, verse 31, O you of little faith, why did you doubt? And he says that to Peter. And when he does, you know, we might sit back and kind of congratulate ourselves on having great faith, but we've never tried it before, have we? We didn't step out there and walk on the water like Peter did. There's another lesson, too, is that when Peter does begin to sink, he does know which way to turn. He says, Lord, save me, and he reaches out to the Lord to save him. And so I find it interesting about Peter's mistakes, as we look at just a couple of these tonight, that even though he made so many mistakes, he would have not made those mistakes if he hadn't been willing to at least do something. Does that make sense? If he hadn't done something, he wouldn't have made those mistakes. But he did. He took the risk and went out and got off the boat and walked. He would have made those mistakes if he hadn't been willing to do something. Here's another example. Mark chapter 9. Look over there. Mark chapter 9. And this is just Mark's record of another event, the Transfiguration. 6 days earlier, Jesus had talked to the disciples and put them to the test and said to the disciples, you know, who do you say that I am? And Peter, of course, is the one who says, Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And he led the group in the response. You know, he's the leader. He's the one that goes out in front and makes the statement. 6 days after that, he takes Peter and James and John up on the mountain with him where he's transfigured. And Moses and Elijah appear. And, of course, that's a big deal to Peter, James, and John because they're Jews. and Moses and Elijah, we talked about this in Bible class there, they'd be the heroes. They'd be Moses, Elijah, Abraham there. They would have been very important. It'd be like us getting the opportunity to sit down with Abraham Lincoln and have a conversation with him. Which Jew wouldn't give his right arm to meet Moses or Elijah who downed the prophets of Baal? You know, these are important men. And Peter's very excited. Look in Mark chapter 9. He sees this happen. He abused Jesus. His garments changed. And he sees, you know, Elijah appear to him and Moses. And Peter answered in verse 5 and says to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. And let us make three tabernacles, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah." For he didn't know what to answer. And then they became terrified. He was very excited. I mean, this is an exciting moment for Peter. He's got to see something that nobody else in his generation would saw. And he wants to build in some tabernacles. That word just means tents. And we speculate about what his motive was. Usually we say maybe he wanted to honor all three of them, show it, you know, to honor these great men. And even Jesus, too, can be among, now honored with Moses and Elijah. And the cloud descends about that time, and the voice comes out of the cloud and says, "This is my beloved Son, listen to him." And then the cloud goes away, and of course Jesus is standing there, and we see the lesson. Peter is learning that this kingdom is very different than the kingdom he's known for. And the voice that rules it and governs it and is not Moses and it's not Elijah. These are not the voices of authority, but only Jesus' voices. So these are lessons we see. But, you know, Peter, you know, we see him and we see his mistake. And he just, we say, this is the time when Peter should have been quiet. This is when time when Peter was impetuous. When he spoke, he probably shouldn't have spoke. He says, let's build three tabernacles for you. And it says that he didn't know what else to say. Look in verse 6. For he didn't know what to answer. He didn't know what to say about this. But he thought of something. Hey, let's do this. And I think that's the point. Was it a mistake? Absolutely. And the Lord corrected him on that. But, you know, he still represents somebody who really loved the Lord. And I think about, he wanted to do something. And I think about, some of us may have been to athletic, youth athletic events and see little kids out there playing ball, or whether it's football or maybe soccer or something. And here's this, all these kids are running around kicking the ball. There's this one kid, he's just standing there. He didn't know what to do. He didn't know where to go that way, or didn't know where to go, didn't know where to go that way. And the coach says, "Just do something." You know? He doesn't know what to do, but he needs to do something. And that's kind of where Peter is. Peter doesn't know what to do. But at least he did something. And I think there's a good lesson for us in that. We need to do something. And if we're off base on it, we're a little bit out of sync with maybe, then somebody will say, "Hey, we need to appreciate your enthusiasm, appreciate your zeal. Let me help guide you just a little bit. Let me give you a little suggestion." And that's all you have to do. A guy with a lot of zeal, a lot of enthusiasm, and a good heart, all you got to do is give him a little suggestion and just tweak him a little bit, and he'll go in the right direction. But when somebody, you know, when somebody tries to do something, that's better than just sitting and doing nothing. And sometimes that's what we might do. We might just be stagnant. We just sit, and we don't help, and we don't offer, and we don't know where to go. And sometimes we need somebody else to help us out, and we get started, but do something. Peter was willing to do something, and he made mistakes. We readily see Peter's mistake. But we need to be more like him rather than be content to stand on the sidelines. We need to do something. And I really think that we become denominational, because there's a great tendency to come and to be ministered unto. Does that make sense? He's our minister. I'm not saying this because I have a personal issue about it. I'm just saying that's a tendency. That's in the denominational world. That's very common, that we go to church to get ministered unto. But we're all ministers. It's just a word that means servant. We're all supposed to be servants. And we get here and we're supposed to figure out, who can we help? Does he need help? Let me go see if I can help. What can I do for you? You know, do something. Not just come to be ministered unto. Jesus said, "I didn't come here to be served. I came here to serve and give myself as a ransom for many." We need to walk in that same kind of direction. And Peter here was ready to do something. Matthew 16, 21. Let's look at another one. Turn over to Matthew 16, verse 21. After this, Jesus begins to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem, the to suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and be raised up on the third day. And so he's telling them what it really means to be the Christ. This is the definition of what it means to be the Messiah. And Peter, of course, verse 22, took him aside and began to rebuke him and said, God forbid it, Lord, this shall never happen to you. He's telling them, now you've got the Messiah, you've got the Lord defining what it meant to be a Messiah. And he's saying, this is what it means. It means about, you know, being arrested and being tried and being mocked and scourged and crucified and died. And for Peter, this is not connecting. This is not in the least bit connected to what he's always perceived to be the role and the mission of the Messiah. And he could have made used Scripture to prove that. We talked about that in our Bible class. There are several good passages in the Old Testament. He could say, look, I've studied this, and this is not what the Messiah does. This is not what's supposed to happen. And so I can see a good reason that Peter might have said that to Jesus. But Jesus very strongly rebukes him. And Peter's response is a little bit ironic, since he had just said, thou art the Christ, the Son of God, and now he tells him he's wrong. I mean, there's just a little inconsistency here in Peter's understanding. And so Jesus says, get behind me, Satan. Those are strong words, verse 23. You're a stumbling block to me, for you are not setting your mind on God's interest, but on man's interest. So Peter is not purely responding to what he studied in his Old Testament. There's a carnal, worldly concept that's floating around in his mind. I mean, he thinks of the kingdom as physical. He thinks of the kingdom as a Messiah who doesn't die, who rules and reigns like any other kind of monarch that's in power. And obviously this is a different kind of kingdom. It's a kingdom where the Messiah is willing to sacrifice himself and die. And that just doesn't fit. And when things don't fit our concept, when something happens that is exactly the antithesis of the way I thought something through, it just messes you all up. And you do all kinds of things that you might ordinarily not do. And that happens to us in our life whenever we think about the kingdom in such and such a way, and we think that this is the way things ought to work out for me when I'm a Christian. And then something goes wrong. And maybe I have to encounter some type of terrible situation. I mean a bad situation that is just totally unfair to me, and it's contrary to what I've always thought. And we just do like Peter. We say, that this is just not right. This is not supposed to happen to me. And that's a good lesson. You know, and a lot of people move away from God and they just quit being a Christian. They just leave him because it's just, things are not the way they had perceived it. It's simply a problem with a misconception. If I don't get my thinking in line with God's purpose, and if any part of my concept of the kingdom of God is like with Peter's, where I'm thinking about man's interest and not God's interest, if my concept is lined up with a carnal concept of God's kingdom, that's going to show up someday. That is going, God, devil's going to use that. In this case, he was using it to try to upset Jesus' work. He was going to try to, if here you got your best friend, Jesus' closest companion, who's trying to talk him out of doing the very thing he came to do. And so Jesus was very straightforward, very harsh. You get behind me, Satan. But I mean, if our concepts aren't in line with what the Bible says, it's very possible and very likely that this is going to happen to us at some point. The very reason that we need to always test our concepts, rethink and recheck the way we think about things, and make sure they're in line with God's purposes and not just our own. Look at another one. Look in John chapter 13. John chapter 13. Peter's mistakes. John chapter 13, verses 5 through 8. This is the night that Jesus was arrested. It's the Passover feast. Jesus has his disciples together. They're all in the room, the upper room. They have prepared things ahead of time. And they're all there waiting, and Jesus arrives. But there's one thing they didn't do that was standard practice in the first century. When you came into a room, you had somebody who washed your feet. You had somebody that, dirty feet, sandy, dirty feet in that day. And so you had someone that normally there's a servant there in the house that it's just a hospitality. You wash the feet, literally, when people came to your house. But that night there's not anybody there because they've rented a room and there's only people there. There's 12 disciples and they're not going to wash anybody's feet. And so verse 5 says, Jesus, or verse 3, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, that he had come forth from God and was going back to God, he rose from supper, laid aside his garments, and taking a towel, he girded himself about, and he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet, and to wipe them with the towel which he was with which he was girded. And so he came to Simon Peter. And Peter says to him, Lord, do you wash my feet? And Jesus answered and said to him, you don't realize. You don't understand it right now. But you will understand it later. And Peter says, Lord, not my feet, but my hand. Peter says, never shall you wash my feet, Lord, never. And you do have to think about how absurd that would seem to Peter. I mean, that does seem like an absurd thing. That if you conceive of Jesus as the up-and-coming king and a monarch and a ruling lord, then you certainly don't, that doesn't fit your concept of one who would wash your feet. Just like we were obviously talking about in the last case. That's like a CEO washing a bathroom stalls out in a truck stop. Just don't picture that kind of thing happening. Whatever the most disgraceful thing you can imagine, that's probably what's in Peter's mind. This is disgraceful. You just can't do something like this. This is beneath you. And even though Jesus tells Peter he can't understand it yet, Peter just won't allow that. And I don't know, but maybe somewhere back in Peter's mind, he realizes there's an implication there. Maybe I'm going to have to do this too. Maybe this might mean I've got to do this kind of thing for other people. And that was way beyond what he was willing to do. Obviously, we know that their aspirations were more carnal and more in line with having power and position, and that was not part of what they imagined themselves being, doing menial tasks such as washing somebody's feet. And Jesus says to him, you better get used to the idea. He says there in verse 8, Peter says, never shall you wash my feet. And Jesus said, if I don't wash you, you have no part with me. And Peter says, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head. Peter doesn't want to make a mistake. He usually realizes that he's put his foot in his mouth, but not until after he said something. He's trying to teach these disciples, obviously, that his kingdom is about service and that glory comes after. It's not now. It's later. And even Paul said, that the sufferings of now are just very little compared with the glory that's to follow. But this is the kingdom of service. And Jesus has, he works in various ways while he's here in this world to try to present that concept, whether it's touching lepers that nobody wants to touch, whether it's hugging children that nobody thinks that are worth hugging, whether it's healing, eating with the publicans and the sinners that are beneath the important Pharisees to eat with, whether it's washing feet or whether it's going to a cross. It's just like this constant stooping, lower and lower and lower and condescending, to a level that's just unimaginable. And if these disciples would watch him, they would see, they're starting to put things together. And Peter's like, I don't want this. This is not for me. And Jesus said, well, you just go ahead and leave then. You just go ahead and leave now, because if you're not willing to do this, you can't be a part of this kingdom. And that is something I have to think about. Do I think of the kingdom as in terms of sharing his glory now, or sharing in service now, learning to be a servant? And putting somebody else's needs ahead of mine and doing things that maybe I would prefer not to do, because I prefer to do this over here. I mean, what is it that was my concept of the kingdom? Service or glory? And that's certainly while we may not, I don't know how much we have a tendency to do that in the congregation, we see that in the denominational world. And we see people who seek for position and power in churches And that's what they're. I remember studying with a young man in Brazil, and he was in the Universal Church of God, and he was a young man, a very zealous young man, very nice guy, and he was at our studies in Rio, and he, by the end of the studies, you know, he had lots of questions, and one of the things he had, he was just on the verge of being invited in his church where he was to count the money. He was going to be involved in counting the offering. And that was a very important position, very much of an honor for him. And I said, well, you know, I'm afraid that if you choose to serve the Lord, that you may have to forfeit that. You know, you may be meeting in a little garage in front of somebody's house. You may be sitting in plastic chairs, and you may be there alone, or you may be there one other person for untold months until you know you can help this group grow. And that may be it. And he just sat there and didn't know what to say, because that was so contrary to the aspirations that he had and the things that were created in the church that he was a part of. And he never, you know, as far as I know, he never did become a Christian, but that's very common in the denominational world. Is it a kingdom of escalation and growing in position, or is it a kingdom of service where you come down the ladder? You go down the rungs of the ladder, not climb up the rungs of the ladder. So there's a good lesson for us, too. All right, one other. Matthew chapter 26, verse 33. We go to the garden scene near the end. And Jesus is with his disciples, and actually this is just before he left and went out to the garden, and he tells them, Jesus again says, you're all going to fall away because of me this night. You're all going to fall away tonight. You're all going to leave me. And after you have been raised, after I've been raised, I'll go before you in Galilee. But verse 33 says, Peter answered and said to him, even though all may fall away because of you, I will never fall away. Peter was very determined to serve the Lord. Very determined to serve the Lord. And he said, even if I have to die, he's still part of his misunderstanding, obviously, the kingdom. He's certainly overconfident. We know that. But Peter was willing to die. I mean, he really meant that. And just a little bit later, we'll talk about this one in just a minute. It won't be but a few hours later that Jesus is going to be approached in the garden by priests and Sadducees and a mob and a Roman cohort, which is somewhere around 600 soldiers. So we've got this monstrous group of people that come up to apprehend the Lord, and Peter draws his sword. He's ready to go to war. I mean, he's ready to fight. And you know, we can be very confident in areas that we feel that we're strong. And Peter may have been a pretty strong fellow. He may have felt he was a good fighter. He was ready to go to fight to the death. But he was ready to die fighting, but he wasn't ready to surrender with him. He wasn't ready. When Jesus said, you know, put your sword away, that was the response that Jesus gave to Peter a little bit later. He said, you put your sword up. Peter was confused because he was ready to fight, but he wasn't ready to surrender. He wasn't ready to be humiliated with him and to give up without a fight. And I think there's a good lesson for us there. You may be ready to die for the Lord. You may be ready to fight to the death. Maybe you're ready to go. I didn't write it down, but there's a famous quote from a man named Polycarp in the second century when a lot of the Christians were being persecuted, and one of the generals, the Roman generals, tried to elicit a confession of Polycarp that he was against the atheists, and that was the Christians. And Polycarp looked around at all the screaming mobs in the stands, the Romans, and he says, I renounce the atheists. And they knew that wasn't what they were asking for. And he ends up burning at the stake. Burn him at the stake. He said, I've served the Christ for 86 years. Why would I want to give that up now? He said, you only have to nail me. They didn't even tie him to the stake. He said, you only have to tie me. I'll just stand here. And he did. They burned him. And he didn't even leave. That's neat. That's powerful. I don't know if I would do that. But Peter, he was willing to die for the Lord. But are we willing to let somebody laugh at us? Are we for the Lord? Are we willing to be ostracized by colleagues for the Lord at work or at school? Are we willing to be passed over for a promotion for the Lord? Or be looked upon as backwards and non-progressive for the Lord? Or are we willing to stand up in a congregation over some kind of Bible issue where the Bible says this, but the whole group is going that way, and you say, I can't do that. That's not what the Bible says. And to have those people say, well, you're just part of that old school. We'll tolerate you. We'll let you be among us. But we're going this way. You know, and to stand there and have the courage to say, that's not right. That's not what the Bible says. You know, am I willing to do that? Peter was ready to fight, but he wasn't ready to surrender in that particular case. John chapter 18 and verse 10. John chapter 18 and verse 10. Simon Peter took his sword and drew it, and he struck the high priest's slave, and he cut off his right ear. And the slave's name was Malchus. And then Jesus says to Peter, put your sword in your sheath, for the cup the Father has given me, shall I not drink yet? So he says, here's our same scene, but he struck the high priest's ear. I doubt he was aiming for his ear. I think he was trying to decapitate him. I think if he had hit him in the neck, that would have been exactly what Peter would have liked to have done. Misunderstanding. Peter misunderstands. He's going to fight on worldly terms. He's going to fight for the Lord on worldly, in a carnal way. I just thought that, I've seen that in churches. Have you? You ever seen people fight issues and deal with issues in a very carnal way? Certainly you have to deal with issues. Have you ever seen a church behave like a bunch of worldly people slinging mud, calling each other names, insulting one another when they're trying to study the Bible to come to understand the truth more accurately? Or are they trying to understand the truth more accurately? But they do a lot of things in their approach to trying to stand for the truth or fight for the truth that's very carnal. And it's a shame. And Jesus has to rebuke Peter for the way that he did it. And I think that's a good lesson. You know, there's a right way to do things, there's a wrong way to do things, and our misunderstandings can lead us to do things the wrong way. But Peter was willing to take a stand and fight for the Lord, are we? Well, the last thing I'll mention is Mark chapter 14. Let's turn there. This will be the last point. Peter looks pretty brave there as Jesus is being arrested, and he pulls out his sword and he's willing to fight. But then all of the disciples flee. But Mark chapter 14, verse 53 and following, kind of records the trial of Jesus. But it sort of brackets another trial. You got the trial of Jesus that took place before the Jews in verses 53 and all the way down through verse 65. And then when you get to chapter 15, you get the trial before Pilate and the Romans. And that takes verse chapter 15 and goes on following. But you know what's that brackets? Brackets another trial. And that's the trial of Peter. Because Peter was on trial that night too. And in verse 66 through the end of chapter 14 in Mark, you see a very different Peter than you saw that was standing in the Garden of Gethsemane. Out there he was, you know, he kind of sneaks back in. They all flee, but Peter kind of sneaks back in to kind of see what's going on, see if he can catch a glimpse and hear what's going on with this trial of Jesus. And you get, so you get this legal trial that's going on with Jesus, who stands quietly and accepts the charges and accusations, and he doesn't say anything. But then the other trial is Peter's personal trial, and he's not being tried by the Sanhedrin, by this Jewish Supreme Court. He's just standing in the courtyard, and there's this maiden, this young lady, and she says, hey, I know you. Aren't you with him? And he says, not me. I wouldn't win. It's not me. And of course, three times in the course of that discussion, he denies the Lord. And while Jesus' approach in his trial was not self-interest, but the interest of others, Peter's approach in his trial is purely selfish interest. He's protecting his own neck. He's trying to avoid getting too closely affiliated with Jesus to be an accomplice, because he doesn't want to end up in the same situation that Jesus is in. And I wonder how embarrassing it was for him when that cock crowed that night, and he remembered, and he looks, and evidently he made eye contact with the Lord somewhere. I wonder how ashamed he would have been when it dawned on him how much he had failed right then. What a failure he must have felt like. And he ran away, and he wept. And we might have a temptation to be kind of a harsh judge towards somebody like that, you know? We might, you know, say, well, I see Peter running away, and after he did that, I wouldn't be too surprised. I mean, after all, you know, he always had a hard time, always ran his mouth too much, always, he's a hypocrite sometimes. We even caught him lying a few times. I mean, you know, we might say, I'm not too surprised. I mean, look at the kind of guy that he was. But in Mark chapter 16, verse 7, you remember that after Jesus was risen from the dead, and he encountered the women, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James, and Salome, and they encountered him on the road, he said, I'm sorry, the angels told them. The angels told these women, verse 7, go and tell his disciples and Peter that he's going before you into Galilee, and there you will see him just as he said to you. There's this reassurance here that that Jesus expected and anticipated to see Peter again. And he spoke him individually. He called his name. Go tell the disciples and tell Peter that I'll be expecting to see him in Galilee, just like I said before. And that's important. I mean, that's important to us. We shouldn't blow by that, because I guarantee you that was important to Peter. I mean, he needed that reassurance that while we may have given up on Peter by that point, Jesus didn't. And even more than just that, he didn't just call him to come and meet him. He still appointed him as the apostle to the Jews, the apostle to the circumcised, as the Gentile, as the Galatians letter said. And so we need to be careful, it's a lesson to me, about being careful about being harsh or being unforgiving, being too judgmental, holding people at a distance when people have failures and they don't do well, comparing myself to others and saying, well, Peter, I'm glad I'm not like him. You know, I'm sure that if the Lord wanted to, he could put out a list of crimes that I've committed that certainly far outstretch maybe Peter's incidents. But we do that when we want to feel good about ourselves, and we shouldn't. And we need to see the Lord's compassion and his confidence that he showed toward Peter that he would come back to him. Well, I'll just go back to the first incident that we mentioned. You can get your songbooks and open them. We're going to sing in just a second, number 359. The incident on the boat where Peter gets off and sinks. We may not have denied the Lord, may not have actually sunk like Peter sank that day, may not have lost our faith in him, but it also could be tonight that you've never taken a risk, that you've never stepped out of the boat. Maybe it's as simple as that you need to be baptized and begin walking toward Jesus and accept that the storms will come. And maybe you haven't done that. Maybe you're afraid. Maybe you're out on the water. Maybe you've taken the initial step. Maybe you can say, I did take a risk. I was baptized. But maybe you haven't really stepped off the boat and done some things that may be impossible from the perspective of the normal person. And maybe you haven't taken any risks because you're afraid you're going to sink. And most likely, if things follow the pattern of Peter, you probably will sink at some point. But if you reach out to him, then he reaches out to you. That's a real lesson. And this is about grace and forgiveness and mercy. It is not about flawless perfection. It's about trusting in God, depending on him, and making yourself available to be a servant of his and let him use you in the way that he would choose to do that. Maybe tonight you would make that choice, and we would invite you to do that while we're standing and singing our song.